Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com, code program.
There's nothing illegal about making a donation to WikiLeaks. So a lot of Americans did do that right after Cablegate, and they went to the WikiLeaks website, and they clicked on donate, and what were their options? It was Visa, MasterCard, PayPal. And when they clicked on those, it said, sorry, we will not process your payments. It's because those companies came under political pressure. Bitcoin does away with that.
Hi, I'm Raihan Salam, and this is the Vice Podcast Show. I'm joined today by Jerry Brito, a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, who blogs regularly at Tech Liberation Front. Jerry, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So, Bitcoin. We've been hearing a lot about it, but what exactly is it?
Well, Bitcoin is the world's first completely decentralized digital currency. And, you know, we've had digital currencies for a long time, right, for decades. If you think about Microsoft points or Facebook credits, these are digital currencies. And we've had payment systems that allow us to exchange money online for a long time. So PayPal, Visa, MasterCard, we've had these things. So what is it about Bitcoin that makes it unique? It's the decentralized part of when I say the world's first decentralized.
Well, yeah. When you say that, you know, points, you mm-hmm. know, Facebook points, you know, frequent flyer miles, et cetera, yeah. I mean, so these are a way for me to acquire some good or service mm-hmm. through this thing, but it's not money. It's not something that I can sort of exchange for just anything. It's something that I can exchange for a particular basket of goods.
You're right, because when you buy Microsoft points, you can then only really use them in the Microsoft store. Although I think there are ways that you could transmit them to another user. But yeah, you're right, sort of limited in scope. But the basic idea is that we have had currencies that are not the U.S. currency or not a state currency. Right, we've had private currencies for a long time, so that's not new about Bitcoin. Mm. What's new is that with Facebook, with Microsoft, with Berkshire's in Berkeley, these are all issued by a central issuer. There's a company that makes up these tokens and hands them out or exchanges them for fiat dollars. With Bitcoin, there is no Bitcoin company. There is no Bitcoin building. There's even not even a Bitcoin server anywhere that you could shut down. It is completely distributed. That's what's unique about Bitcoin. It is, for the first time, a way for the two of us to exchange value online without a third-party intermediary. Until the invention of Bitcoin, for you and me to exchange money online, we had to employ a third party, like PayPal, like Visa, like MasterCard, right? And the reason for that was very simple. If I wanted to send you money online, what would that look like? Well, money would have to be some kind of digital file, right? So let's say I want to send you $100. That $100 would basically be some kind of $100 file that I would attach to a message and send to you. Now, it's the same as if I sent you a photo or a Word document. When I send you a photo or a Word document, does it get deleted from my computer? Nope,
it doesn't.
So then I still have the exact replica of that file, and I could then spend it a second time, a third time, a fourth time. And that's what computer scientists called the double spending problem. So it wasn't until the invention of Bitcoin.
You could spend the same amount of money multiple times, and there's no way to be sure that you're not doing
sure.
that.
To be sure, right. When you got some money, there's no way that you know that you knew this was legit. Bitcoin solved that problem for the first time. That's the genius of Bitcoin. The way that we solved it before Bitcoin is that we employed a third party, somebody like PayPal. And what they did was that they kept a ledger. Essentially, PayPal is a big ledger. You have an account, I have an account. When I send you $100, they deduct it from my account, they add it to yours. And at the end of the day, all of PayPal's accounts across all of its customers have to reconcile to zero. Bitcoin essentially does the same thing, but without PayPal. And the way it does that is there's still a ledger where everything reconciles, but that ledger is distributed peer-to-peer amongst all of the users. That's the genius of Bitcoin.
So let's talk a little bit more about currency as we conventionally understand it. Now, when you think about a U.S. dollar, it is a scrap of paper. There's some linen in there, basically. But for whatever reason, you know, people, when you hand them over a $100 bill, they will hand you over an exchange, goods and services.
Right.
Now, let's understand a little bit, I mean, why is that, period?
It's a good question. And the nature of money is something that has driven a lot of people crazy, trying to understand why it works the way it does. But at bottom, it's just faith. It's just the faith that we all have that if I accept a $100 bill, when I, a week from now, I should be able to exchange this for goods at that, at my grocer. And we all have faith in this piece of paper.
And that faith is ultimately undergirded by the authority of a kind of central institution.
Not really, right? Because Bitcoin is a good counterexample of that. There's no central institution.
Well, but that's
Bitcoin.
Why I just want to focus a little bit about money as we know it. So when you're thinking, when you talk about faith, you know, what is it that we have faith in? We have the faith. So, you know, the dollar is backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government.
Right.
And so we know that actually, you know, one is obligated to honor the value of this currency.
Not really, right? So, so the dollar has an advantage that private currencies don't, right? So government currencies have an advantage, and they're the following. Number one, you can only pay your taxes in dollars. So we all owe taxes, and that can only be paid in dollars. So you have to have dollars.
So in a way, the market share of a dollar is protected by this protectionist measure, which is to say that the government will only accept dollars.
Absolutely.
So I need to acquire dollars somehow in order to fulfill my obligations.
Correct. And the second thing is all contracts can be settled with dollars. So if you and I sort of have a contract, say I sell you my car, but even if we denominate that contract in euros, right, if you default and we go to court and I say, okay, I'll pay you, here are dollars, you have to take dollars in settlement of a contract. So those two things are sort of the backstop. But short of that, it is just the faith that we have.
Well, and certainly when we think about these government-backed currencies, there has been a long history of currencies before government-backed currencies.
Sure.
And, you know, in the past, one would, for example, you know, use precious metals. You would use gold. That was a kind of very popular one and still is to some degree. And so, you know, I'm giving you gold and I have faith that you will treat this as value, or when I accept it, I have faith this will retain its value and I will be able to use this in the future. So it's similarly a kind of faith-based currency.
Yes, that's right. And I think that that's where the analogy for Bitcoin starts to break down.
Because when you say that Bitcoin is not based on faith in the same way as a traditional government-backed currency or, you know, precious metal, that's kind of an interesting idea, and I kind of want to really...
Well, no, I think Bitcoin is based on
faith.
Right?
But it's based on a different kind of...
No, it's the same faith. It's the same faith because, the reason you have, use Bitcoin is because you think that next week you'll be able to spend that Bitcoin for goods and services. Mm. Now, Bitcoin is very volatile. Look, currency has three things that make currency currency, or make money money. One is you can use it as a store of value. One is that you can use it as a unit of account. And the other is that you can use it as a medium exchange. Hmm. I think Bitcoin is an excellent medium of exchange for the reasons that I explained a minute ago. It allows us now to transact online without third parties. Lots of benefits to that that we can get into. But as a unit of account and as a store of value, I think Bitcoin still has to prove itself, right? So as a unit of account, it's so volatile.
Well, we should slow down a bit to get into that. But so when you're thinking about those three purposes, when you're thinking about a traditional currency, it has a lot of attractive features, partly because if you think about the U.S. dollar, you know, its value relative to other currencies certainly fluctuates over time. Its real value in terms of the goods that one can purchase with it also fluctuates over time, but it tends to do so very slowly.
Very slowly.
And so it's become kind of a standard thing for people to use, kind of when they're concerned about the erosion of the value of their assets. So beyond the kind of monopoly virtues that it has in the sense that, you know, you can use it to pay taxes, et cetera, you know, it has these other values of stability as well. Now, one reason why Bitcoin has attracted so much attention is precisely because, you know, whereas one of these discrete units, a lowercase b Bitcoin, used to be, you know, worth virtually nothing. Now it's worth quite a lot, and it keeps. Tell me a little bit about the volatility.
Right. So just to say quickly, though, that that's part of the reason why the U.S. dollar, what you just described, the fact that it fluctuates in value very slowly. That's the reason why you would say the U.S. dollar is a good store of value and a good unit of account. You and I probably wouldn't have a problem setting up a contract to sell you a car in dollars because probably a dollar is going to be worth a dollar in a week's time, right? Whereas a Bitcoin, we don't know. It's very volatile. Same thing with the store of value. A dollar is going to be worth a dollar in a week's time. Not the case probably with the Bitcoin. So why is it so volatile? I think it's just there's nothing inherent in Bitcoin that makes it volatile, although there is no central bank that can ease that volatility. The real reason that Bitcoin is volatile is that it's thinly traded. It's a very illiquid market. The Bitcoin market today is about $10 billion is the market cap of Bitcoin. So in the grand scheme of things, it's kind of small. And a lot of the Bitcoins that are out there are just being held for speculative purposes. And so as a result, any one trade that's sufficiently big enough sends the Bitcoin prices, you know, really roiling. And so with news, either positive or negative, you see a lot of people coming in and out of the market, and you really see these fluctuations. As more people, more merchants, more institutions begin to use Bitcoin, and demand for Bitcoin goes up, and it's more heavily traded, and also eventually you might even get the ability to short Bitcoins and get other derivatives, you should see, hopefully, the price of Bitcoin ease out.
So you think that it's simply a matter of time as more people enter the market. One argument that's been raised is that, in fact, you'll never see that because the kind of people who culturally gravitate towards Bitcoin are paranoid about inflation. Or another argument that I've heard, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but another argument that I've heard is that, well, as they grow more valuable, people you know, won't want to part with them. And so, but you know, it seems
it's
to me
deflationary,
as though, and it seems to me as though that doesn't make a ton of sense just because as a Bitcoin becomes more and more valuable, presumably the opportunity cost of hoarding Bitcoin also becomes very high.
That's right. But I think that, again, it's Bitcoin's value as a medium of exchange that really is the important thing here. So, yes, people right now, especially early adopters, have all sorts of different reasons for being early adopters. A lot of them are ideological reasons, right? So people will be into Bitcoin because they're gold bugs and they're afraid of inflation.
Very recently, Ron Paul, the former Republican presidential candidate, talked about how we'll no longer need the U.S. dollar because of Bitcoin, which, you know, seemed like a pretty big endorsement, although not necessarily kind of a, you know, a very accurate characterization of how this is likely to unfold.
What's funny is that he actually I was very skeptical of Bitcoin a few months earlier. I saw an interview with him, and he said, you can't put them in your pocket, so I don't think it's real money, something to that extent. So, yes, it was interesting to see that about face. But look, Bitcoin is a medium of exchange, and other properties around Bitcoin that make it really interesting make it valuable. And that's why more people are going to come into the market, why more merchants are going to begin to accept it. Quite honestly, because you can think of Bitcoin as a alternative to traditional or to existing payment, electronic payment methods like Visa, MasterCard, PayPal, Western Union, that is cheaper and faster in some times.
So basically, though you have some people, some Bitcoin enthusiasts who see it as a way to replace existing government-backed currencies, another way to think about it is that, well, no, this is a layer that could, you know, kind of atop existing traditional currencies or whatever else that happens to be useful for other purposes. And we use, you know, when you look at, you know, payment services, this is a sector with only a small handful of business enterprises. And because there are network effects in that business, I mean, they tend to be very, very entrenched. So when you're thinking about Visa, MasterCard, you know, PayPal as well, although it's operating at a different layer as well. So I guess, you know, you don't just have to think about Bitcoin as an alternative to the dollar. You can think of it as an alternative to Visa, MasterCard, and PayPal.
Look, there's no reason why Bitcoin couldn't be an alternative to a national currency. People think it someday could be a global currency, and perhaps. But to me, that is really far off into the future. I don't see it really displacing the dollar or the euro anytime soon. It might displace the Argentinian currency. It might displace some African currencies a lot sooner. But to me, since that's so far away, that's not as interesting as what you were saying, the challenge that it poses, the disruption that it poses to existing payment systems.
The Visa MasterCard duopoly has been around for a very long time. PayPal has, at this point, been around for a reasonably long time. Yeah. These services work tolerably well.
Yeah.
They're reliable. They're relatively good at combating fraud and much else. So why would I want an alternative necessarily? If I'm a small business owner or if I'm a consumer, you know, what is it about Bitcoin that is so compelling relative to these pretty sophisticated payment services?
Right. So let me answer first your question directly. Why would a consumer or a merchant care? And then maybe we can get to why people who love democracy might care. So the reason that a merchant might prefer to take Bitcoin is it's cheaper and it's faster. So think of a dry cleaner, right? Small mom and pop store wants to accept electronic payments. So what are their options right now? Well, their options are they can go to a credit card network, some other kind of payment network. Number one, they need to apply for permission. They need to apply for membership in the network, and that costs money. And then let's say they get accepted. They then face merchant fees that are pretty high. So if they're a small business, each swipe of a credit card when they bring up a sale, it's going to be about 25 cents just for the swipe. And in addition to that, it's going to be about 3 to 5% of the total bill that they're ringing up. That's can be quite a sizable amount for a small business. You often will see, especially you go to a dry cleaner, it'll say no credit cards for anything under $15. It's because of these merchant fees. Let's compare that to Bitcoin. With Bitcoin, there's no membership. You don't need to apply. You just join the network. It's permissionless. Once you're accepting Bitcoin, there's no cost per swipe, and the merchant fees are going to be about 1% or less. Very attractive to merchants. For consumers, these merchant fees are passed along to consumers. What you see oftentimes today is merchants who accept Bitcoin saying, if you pay in Bitcoin, we will give you a 10% discount. You see this across the web, Subway, sandwich shops. For some reason, now are accepting Bitcoins, different franchises are, and your sandwich is cheaper if you pay in Bitcoin because there is no merchant fee there.
So this raises the possibility that you have these entrenched payment services that haven't really attracted much in the way of competition. Well, partly because they're so entrenched, it's just very hard for some alternative guy to come in and say to every merchant across the country, hey, use me.
Right.
It sounds as though this could be pressure that would lead them to lower their fees. Can you imagine a scenario in which these guys lower their fees enough that Bitcoin becomes less attractive? Or do you think that Bitcoin has intrinsic advantages relative to kind of third-party payment services?
So no, I don't see them lowering their traditional payment systems. And I'll tell you why. It's because they're providing something for those fees. It's not as if they're just charging high fees for the sake of it. You get something for those fees. You get first of all, these credit card companies are in the business of lending money. Bitcoin is like cash. You either have it or you don't. It's literally cash. So there's no spending money that you don't have. Credit card companies allow you to do that. So that's one thing. And those are the consumer fees. On the merchant side...
And that in itself presumably accounts for some of the difference.
Yes, absolutely. And then the other part of it is what credit card companies and companies like PayPal offer that Bitcoin does not is insurance. If you order something, say from eBay, and it comes in the mail, it's not you pay with PayPal, it comes in the mail, it's not what you ordered or something wrong with it or some sort of fraud, you can call up PayPal and they will reverse the charge. If you have your identity stolen, somebody runs up charges on your credit card, you're not liable for those. Credit card company eats those. Well, somebody's got to pay for all that. Well, that comes from the fees. So you're getting something for those fees. Bitcoin is like cash. So to me, Bitcoin is a new option for consumers.
So there will be a role for these services that are providing those insurance-like features to consumers and merchants alike. But it's possible that that role will be smaller because you're going to have an alternative that's going to be able to operate. And also, the need for certain kinds of insurance will be less great when you're dealing with a ledger in which you know that party A has these resources that party B is then taking in exchange for this good or service. But there are other kinds of insurance then, for example, this product is substandard or the product doesn't arrive, that can't handle.
Right, and just all the other benefits that credit card companies might offer, like airline miles or a concierge service. They're bundling a whole bunch of services.
So Bitcoin is basically taking one piece of the bundle that is a pretty big chunk of the bundle,
yes.
Whereas the payment services, partly because they're dealing with so many merchants and so many consumers, they have come to accrete more and more to the bundle. And so, in a way, they're vulnerable to this kind of unbundling.
I tell you who is much more vulnerable are the money transmitters, the pure money transmitters. So we're talking about Western Union. Their service is simply sending money from point A to point B.
In Bitcoin, a primer for policymakers, you observe that something on the order of over $400 billion in remittances flowed from migrants in one part of the world to their families and friends in another part of the world, and that Western Union and other wire services like it charge something on the order of 9% to transmit those funds.
Yeah, I have to give a shout out to my co-author on that, Andrea Castillo, who did a lot of work looking at the remittances. Remittances from the developed world to the developing world is just a huge, it's like a $7 billion.
It also dwarfs the amount of overseas development assistance.
That's absolutely right. Recently, I helped my mother send money back home. She's from Spain. And it was 5%. It was amazing to me. We found a reputable, good, fast online money transmitter, and we sent money back home to her brother, and it was 5% of total amount. Now, we live in the 21st century. If we want to have a video call to China, we can do that for free. But to send a couple $100, which is essentially just ones and zeros being moved around, costs 5% plus takes over a day.
What is so when you're talking about the payment services, there's some justification that you've just outlined for why they would want to charge these fees, because they're taking on a not inconsiderable amount of risk. Whereas if I am Western Union and I'm taking funds from a worker from Kerala who's living in Abu Dhabi and sending it back to his family home, like what is the risk that I am taking on as Western Union or some other wire transmitting service?
I'm not sure what the risk is. I haven't looked into that very much, but there is a series of networks that interconnect, and each of those interconnections introduces different transaction costs. And I think that's where the cost is. With Bitcoin, because it is one network and it is distributed, it's going to be much cheaper.
So, literally, I mean, there's kind of the matter of getting it from here to there over the wires. I mean, that involves some friction. Mm-hmm. It presumably doesn't involve 9% of a transaction or 5% of a transaction worth of friction.
And then you also have the following. You're going to have agents in each of these countries that is where your family can go and pick it up, and that is also infrastructure. Mm. And what some Bitcoin startups are doing now is they're trying to work with the infrastructure that is already existing there. Oftentimes that has been built out by existing money transmitters, and making them agents of their companies that are using the Bitcoin infrastructure, the Bitcoin network, to make those remittances possible.
And also, as smartphones and other devices become more pervasive, even in the developing world, it could be that that infrastructure is more of a kind of transitional thing. So actually, these wire services might have been vulnerable to some kind of disruption regardless, but this is something that accelerates it and also has this other intrinsic advantage.
In Kenya, M-Pesa is very popular. And recently, the company
can you describe what M-Pesa is?
So M-Pesa basically is a digital currency that is being provided by the national telecom. And basically, it's kind of like points that you can trade from cell phone to cell phone. And somebody here in the U.S. can basically top up somebody's number of points, and they're basically currency. They have added a Bitcoin extension. So now it's very easy to use Bitcoin to bridge between Bitcoin and M-Pesa.
So you see remittances as one area where Bitcoin could have tremendous potential.
I think so. And I think that there are, like I said, several startups that see the same thing.
When you talk about the cost differential, between using one of the traditional payment services, credit cards, et cetera, and Bitcoin, tell us a bit about some of the businesses, the direct consumer businesses that are starting to exploit this.
Direct to consumer. So right now it's in a very, very nascent stage. So it's a disparate sort of cohort of groups. So you'll have cupcake shops and Subway sandwich shops, but then you'll also have WordPress.com and Reddit and OkCupid, so a lot of internet companies. Recently, I saw somebody bought a Tesla from a Tesla dealership. So it's a really disparate group.
You mentioned BitStore, which sounds like a fascinating...
Yeah, Bitcoin Store. Mm-hmm. BitcoinStore.com is... essentially, an electronic store. It's kind of like a looks like Amazon's electronic section. So they sell DVD players, MP3 players, computers, that sort of thing. And again, when they only accept Bitcoin for payment, and so their prices are 5 to 10% below Amazon's, which is crazy because Amazon's kind of like the Walmart of the internet. But again, it's because the merchant fees are so low. They're willing to make those prices lower, pass on the savings to the consumer.
It seems like something that Amazon might want to be aware of.
Yes.
And wary of.
Yes.
So I wonder, when you're talking about this distinction between store of value and mm-hmm. medium of exchange, mm-hmm. we've talked a bit about the potential for Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, but just to be very, very clear mm-hmm. about this. So the volatility of Bitcoin is such that, at some point, I believe the peak price was close to...
1,200. Yes, it was 1,200.
Fascinating.
A couple of weeks ago, yeah. Oh, it's about 1,000 right now.
And tell me, what has been the kind of lowest price within the space of the last year,
roughly? The space of the last year, below 100. So, yeah.
Got it. Yeah. So tell me about, so clearly it's a store of value. I mean, that's something that's going to make me very anxious.
But it's not a good store of value. Oh, yeah, it's not a good store of value.
As you point out. But, so what you're telling me is that what I might do, I might use Bitcoin kind of as this layer for payments. So that, I'm using the dollar as a store of value, yet only for the few seconds before I make transaction X. And it's also a dynamic process mm-hmm. in which the Bitcoin price is always changing mm-hmm. because the real unit of account mm-hmm. Is actually in dollars.
Right.
I'm just using this as a kind of layer, just as we use, kind of any number of third-party services. Is that a fair
characterization? I think that's right. So, again, the hope is that the volatility will subside and you'll be able to just use Bitcoin. But until then, you have payment processors like BitPay. And what BitPay does is it provides merchant services. So if you want to buy stuff from WordPress.com or Reddit, you will essentially be using BitPay. You go to their payments page, and you send Bitcoin. And what WordPress sees is they just see a deposit of dollars into their bank account. They never touch the Bitcoins. BitPay takes care of all of that, and they assume the risk, and they charge a fee for that. And I'm sure that they're hedging on the other end.
Recently, Fight for the Future, a pressure group mm-hmm. that is devoted to fighting internet censorship, mm-hmm. among other issues, decided that it was going to embrace mm-hmm. Bitcoin as one of its political causes. Now, this struck some people as notable because Fight for the Future is a group that is generally seen as left of center, whereas when you talk about the early adopters for Bitcoin, it's tended to be people who are, broadly speaking, libertarians, mm-hmm. people who are very concerned about the debasement of the U.S. currency, people who might otherwise be attracted to gold, mm-hmm. People who come from a very different political sensibility. Now, why do you think that Bitcoin is proving attractive not just to libertarians who are skeptical about government and its ability to preserve the value of a currency, but to other people as well?
Yeah, I think there are two reasons why libertarians, and indeed anybody, are interested in Bitcoin. One is the monetary aspect, which I think is very interesting, but to me, not the most interesting thing to me. The most interesting thing to me is Bitcoin's censorship resistance. So what does that mean? As you said, there are only a handful of payment processors that really all transactions could go through. So it's best, I think, to illustrate it with a story. WikiLeaks, right? When WikiLeaks first put out its Cablegate memos, the State Department memos, this made a lot of people upset in the U.S. government. It also thrilled a lot of just citizens in the country who wanted to show solidarity with WikiLeaks by making a donation. And there's nothing illegal about making a donation to WikiLeaks. It's a nonprofit, and you're an American with your hard-earned cash. You want to give it to them. It's perfectly legal. And so a lot of Americans did do that right after Cablegate, and they went to the WikiLeaks website, and they clicked on Donate. And what were their options? It was Visa, MasterCard, PayPal. And when they clicked on those, it said, sorry, we will not process your payments. Why? Well, it's because those companies came under political pressure not to transact with WikiLeaks, not to process payments. And indeed, PayPal even froze the accounts of WikiLeaks, their existing accounts, so they couldn't even touch their money. Bitcoin does away with that. because there is no third party you have to use, and indeed it's just a handful, as you say, of payment processors that the government would have to put pressure on, either by passing a law or by just putting political pressure on, with Bitcoin, there is no prior restraint. The government may punish you after the fact for a transaction, for an illegal transaction, but they can no longer prevent the transaction from occurring. That's a power that they no longer have.
One implication of this is that, well, so thinking through the specific example of WikiLeaks, one could imagine a scenario in which Congress passes a law that says that, in fact, no, you cannot transfer money to this organization, et cetera. Now, that's a somewhat time-consuming process, but, you know, one can imagine a scenario in which you do something like that. And so the censorship, here you have this scenario in which what appears to have happened is that, you know, we're in a panic mode. This organization is now sort of, become widely recognized. Some money is going to flow towards it. Let's stop this. We don't have time to pass formal legislation. It's not even clear that we would be able to pass formal legislation to do this, but let's use our leverage and threat to get these centralized institutions that have all kinds of reasons to want to have a good relationship with the government to take this step. But, you know, even in the scenario in which you do go through all the formal channels and pass a law, Bitcoin allows you to do an end run around that. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that we have a condition of total anarchy because, you know, I could still punish you after the fact for it, but you cannot prevent that from happening initially. Is that, so that's what you're...
I think it's absolutely right. And so think of, I mean, I think gambling is a good example that would help us think through the implications. So online gambling is legal in the U.S. It's illegal for me to go online and play, you know, some poker and make a bet. How is that enforced? Well, the companies, the online casinos, are usually based overseas in jurisdictions where gambling is legal, so we don't enforce law against them. The players are usually going to be hardworking Americans who, after a hard day's work, come home, just want to have a little bit of fun. It probably wouldn't be too politically palatable to raid the homes of tens of thousands of people who are just trying to have a little fun at home. So who is it that is a target of these laws? It is the payment processors. The payment processors were told you cannot process payments for the purpose of online gambling. So that's how we enforce the law. If you take that out of the equation, and indeed we see today that the vast majority, not total amount in dollars, but the total number of transactions in the Bitcoin economy today are gambling. And it's probably Americans. I have no way of telling, but I imagine it's probably Americans. So now, if the government wants to go enforce this law, wants to make good on its threat, it's going to have to go after individuals. And we'll see how palatable that is. And we'll see how long that law lasts if indeed there is a persecution of individuals.
Now, this is, of course, one of the great anxieties about Bitcoin and its potential. One could argue that, you know, look, whatever you think about gambling laws, there is some, you know, logical, some find it more plausible than others, but rationale for banning gambling. You could say that, look, we're concerned about the minority people who are problem gamblers. We're worried about, people who, kind of have a different kind of time preference or whatever else who actually might wind up squandering resources and becoming public charges. So we have some reason to want to do this. And it seems as though in this world, we could still formally ban gambling, but what you're saying is that ban is no longer effective, and so it's something that just exists on the books, but is largely irrelevant. And that presumably also engenders, a contempt for the laws that can actually be enforced in practice, and that seems potentially pretty dangerous. I mean, if you're concerned about state authority and the legitimacy of state authority and the efficacy of state authority, then it seems like this is something that you can see why policymakers might be pretty concerned.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that what you're saying is a very valid argument. I'm just telling you it's a fact. And so what's going to be very interesting is to see how it is that regulators and policymakers react to this new state of affairs. I think to date they've been acting actually kind of intelligently. So when the Silk Road was first sort of discussed in the mainstream press, Silk Road being this black market online for drugs and other illegal goods, Chuck Schumer held a press conference a couple days after Adrian Chen broke it in Gawker, and he said, "We must, shut down Silk Road. I call upon the FBI to do so. And Bitcoin's only purpose is to launder money and to facilitate this. So we should basically shut it down as well." So it's like an immediate reaction. But since then, you've seen legislators and policymakers come to the understanding that, oh, number one, there are tons of potentially beneficial uses here that would benefit consumers and the economy. But also, perhaps they're understanding if we try to simply shut it down, it is only going to drive it into the underground. So it becomes a purely underground currency that probably breeds more contempt. So how can we work within this new state of affairs? And so recently at Senate hearings, Chuck Schumer said, oh, you know, I was taken out of context. I never said we should ban Bitcoin, but we should look at how to work, blah, 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 blah. So it's interesting to see how this is developing.
Well, let's elaborate on this a little bit more. Yeah. So when you're saying that, you know, look, even if you do have these anxieties about what Bitcoin might mean, mm-hmm. how it might undermine state authority, the idea of Bitcoin exists in the world.
Right.
And so the idea of ledger-based money of this kind, the idea of a decentralized peer-to-peer currency mm-hmm. Or post-currency or whatever you want to call it of this kind exists in the world.
Yeah.
And once that genie is out of the bottle, you know, it could reemerge very easily no matter what you try to do to destroy the network. You could try to find, you know, kind of computers that are mining bitcoins or what have you and impound them and destroy them. But, well, I mean, that's certainly not going to stop the underlying phenomenon from reemerging because it's so valuable.
Bitcoin is very resilient, and it's very resilient to attack. That said, the NSA probably has the capacity, the sheer computing capacity, to carry out any number of attacks that could essentially destroy the Bitcoin network. Okay, but if they did that, it would just spring up as Bitcoin 2.0 or Raihan coin or something else within a matter of minutes. And that idea of we no longer need intermediaries in order to transact online, as you say, that genie is out of the bottle. There's no going
back. So in a sense, if I'm a policymaker, the tack that I might want to take is take a fairly laissez-faire attitude or, you know, so as to encourage the emergence of intermediaries mm-hmm. that want stability, that want to operate above in an above-board mm-hmm. fashion, in a legitimate fashion, so that those intermediaries then become vulnerable.
That's absolutely right, and you can see that that's what's happening today. So consumers are not going to want to download the Bitcoin software, and they're not going to want to meet with somebody on the street to exchange dollars for bitcoins and then keep it on their laptop. And, you know, it's very complicated. They're going to want a turnkey solution, a consumer solution. So they're going to want exchanges that are trustworthy, that are regulated. They're going to want online wallet services that are as easy as PayPal. And so these are cropping up, and these are the ones that consumers are flocking to. And these today are regulated. The Bank Secrecy Act applies to them, so they need to, when they have a new customer, they have to identify that customer, make sure they know exactly who that person is, and they have to keep a record of all transactions. And indeed, Bitcoin really facilitates that because technically, the way Bitcoin operates, all transactions are kept in a public ledger that's open and available for everybody to see. So yes, so these new intermediaries are being created, and regulators are regulating them, but you always have the option to indeed download the software to your laptop and transact directly on the network with somebody else.
The publicness of the ledger seems to be an aspect of Bitcoin that even many Bitcoin enthusiasts don't fully understand. Some time ago, I recall having had a conversation with a friend who was very enthusiastic about the Silk Road, mm-hmm. the service that you had mentioned, and had used it to purchase various controlled substances, and he was talking about its anonymity.
Anonymity, yeah.
and the thing that struck me is that, well, wait a second. You know, cash is actually far more anonymous because, given that you have a ledger,
right?
And if you can figure out who is engaging in which transaction, which seems not an insurmountable technical problem, then you actually have a very good sense of who is engaging in which transactions.
That's right. I mean, cash is, people have this idea that Bitcoin is completely anonymous, and it is not. It is pseudonymous. It's a better way to think about it. Cash is completely anonymous, right? Because if you and I, you put an ad up on Craigslist, I answer it, we meet on a street corner somewhere, I give you cash, you give me whatever, we go our separate ways, that's an anonymous transaction because there's, you know, I don't know your name, you don't know my name. There's no record of that transaction ever taking place, of the amount of the time, totally anonymous. On the other hand, you have credit card transactions, other electronic payments, where you know your name is known to the credit card company, my name is known to the credit card company, and the credit card company keeps a record of the date and time and amount of the transaction, sometimes even the purpose of the transaction, totally identified. Bitcoin is somewhere in the middle, where there is a record kept of the time and amount of the transaction. It's necessary because, you know, to be a distributed ledger, but our names are not attached to those. But as you say, you have new intermediaries that are attaching names to Bitcoin addresses.
Yeah, if I'm a third-party service, given that I'm, you know, operating under the Bank Secrecy Act, et cetera, I mean, I need to have that information. But also, I might just be able to use, you know, data mining technology, the same things that undermine data anonymization in other contexts.
There has to be some hook that that associates some name with a transaction, and then you can work your way back from there. So it is possible to remain anonymous on using Bitcoin, but it is incredibly, incredibly difficult.
And yeah, it probably takes a lot of sophistication and tradecraft to be able to do that.
That's right. Mm-hmm. It's something that you'd probably have to meet somebody anonymously on the street to exchange paper cash for Bitcoins. And then you have to keep your wallet separate so that you never use that wallet for anything else that could tie you to...
It seems like a potentially promising business for you to go into, Jerry.
There are actually extensions to Bitcoin and new currencies being developed that try to improve on the privacy of the cryptocurrency. So it probably doesn't need me. There are cryptographers out there right now who are working on solving that.
Though I wonder... to what extent is the fact that it's you know that one is using pseudonyms rather than you know kind of achieving perfect anonymity? Mm-hmm. To what extent is that a feature rather than a bug? Because it does seem as though it, are there any virtues to that? I mean, kind of you know for something where you can ultimately trace the identities as opposed to an alternative in which you would have a much harder time doing so.
Well, I mean, the virtue is the network. The virtue is that only because you're using pseudonyms that can you verify that you're not spending money twice. Right, because you know that this particular pseudonym, this particular, basically it's a long string of characters, it's an address, has this money and isn't spending it twice, and that you know, you can do.
So it's the consistency that makes that attractive.
It makes it counterfeit proof.
Yeah. Got it. Whereas a system that were truly anonymous, you know, perhaps it's possible to eliminate the danger of counterfeiting, but it would be more difficult.
No, I think it would be easy to counterfeit a completely anonymous. So it's something else we were talking about. Whether regulators are concerned about Bitcoin. They're actually more concerned about centralized digital currencies, right? So like I said, Bitcoin is a decentralized digital currency. All of the transactions are perfectly public. You also have centralized digital currencies that are used in the black market and are used by criminals. So Liberty Reserve is a good example of one of these. Liberty Reserve was shut down a few months ago. And there you basically had a PayPal that was a criminal enterprise and made it so that they would hide the transactions. They would not answer subpoena. They would not know you're a customer. And so as a result, you can imagine that they could manipulate and inflate the prices of different things easily.
Interesting. So if I'm a law enforcement official, I might prefer Bitcoin to a centralized digital currency that is just because it's so much more opaque.
The Secret Service said as much at the recent Senate hearings, where they said, number one, they're way more concerned about centralized digital currencies. If you're trying to move large amounts of cash, you're going to be using a centralized digital service. And they also said, boy, if they want to use something where there's a record kept of everything, like Bitcoin, that's music to our ears. Now, again, we have to remember Bitcoin, while it's not anonymous, it's still censorship resistant, right? So the regulator might be able to find you and punish you, but they can't prevent the transaction from happening. That's a key thing to keep in mind.
Let's go on a little bit of a tangent and talk about the Silk Road, which you had mentioned earlier on. Now, one of the things I found most interesting is that you know this Bitcoin mini boom we're going through right now happened after the collapse of the Silk Road. And when the collapse of the Silk Road happened, many people believed, well, gosh, you know, given that the Silk Road had become so identified with Bitcoin in the public imagination, you know, surely this means that, you know, this flash in the pan will go away. And there were a lot of people who really believed that the Silk Road was just a much more robust system than it turned out to be in practice. So let's talk a little bit about that. Can you describe it?
Yeah, I mean, so the thing about Silk Road is...
So Silk Road was a website that one could only access via a particular kind of browser, the Tor browser. You couldn't just get it on Firefox or Chrome or whatever else. And the Tor browser was built precisely because it's so kind of robust against censorship and surveillance.
So Tor is an anonymizing network. And Tor allows you to provide what's called a hidden service, which is essentially a website, but one where the authorities or anybody else looking can't tell what your IP address is. And as a result of it, they can't tell what where your IP address is. They can't know physically where you are to go and shut you down and seize
it. So in a sense, it's an analog to Bitcoin in being decentralized.
It's very interesting. It is really the intersection. So we've had Tor for a while, but when Bitcoin came in the scene, it was that combination of being able to remain anonymous in space and a way to transact with other people who are anonymous in space one-to-one without the need of a third party that really made things like Silk Road possible for the first time. And so Silk Road set up shop, and it was essentially an eBay-type service for illicit goods, including drugs, fake IDs, that sort of thing.
And it only accepted payment.
It only accepted payment in Bitcoin. I think one has to be fair, has to say that Bitcoin was bootstrapped in part by the black market, right? Because without something like the Silk Road, there would just be computer geeks and gold bugs and other enthusiasts in it.
So the Silk Road greatly increased the number of people who are aware of Bitcoin's existence.
It basically was a proof of concept. I think eventually Bitcoin would have had some sort of proof of concept. But you can imagine that because of its pseudonymity and because of Tor's anonymity, it was only a matter of time if somebody had the light bulb idea. In fact, the light bulb idea to use DigiCash and anonymizing networks was probably had by the cypherpunks in the mid to late 90s. They were just waiting for the thing, the technology, to come around, and then it did. What Silk Road showed is you can have a completely anonymous market, and more importantly, what it showed is you could have sort of dispute mediation and in a completely unpoliced environment, right? So, notwithstanding the fact that the alleged sort of operator of Silk Road ordered to have some men killed, apparently people who you should ask your friend were very satisfied. It's certainly less dangerous than trying to go somewhere physically to buy drugs. And people, had different ratings. So the good sellers were rewarded with more sales. The bad sellers were put away. There were dispute mediation. So it seemed to work.
Well, there was also a certain bravado among people who are users of the site because they were so confident in its security. And that's the thing that I found really shocking when it ultimately fell apart. Because, I think that when we hear talk of Bitcoin, the talk is more convincing when we talk of its resilience to me. But I think that certainly the idea of the Silk Road as a very resilient and kind of, and robust system seemed pretty plausible to me at the time, too.
So I think, I was saying for a while before the Silk Road was taken down that you'd have to be pretty dumb to think that this was going to last forever and, it was only a matter of time.
What made it vulnerable?
Well, this is what's interesting. There's nothing about Bitcoin that made it vulnerable. And there doesn't seem to be anything about Tor that made it vulnerable. What made it vulnerable was that their humans were involved. And these humans made mistakes that gave away their identity. In particular, it seems that the alleged operator made some just key mistakes that allowed the authorities to identify him. So I think it's as we said before, you can remain anonymous using Bitcoin. It just takes a lot of work and one little slip up and you're done. It's the same thing with Silk Road.
It's kind of the contact points between, this world of anonymity and the world outside of it. You're presumably going to want to take your ill-gotten gains and spend them somehow. You're presumably going to want at some point to kind of translate that into some other kind of cash. And all of these little all of these transactions introduce new frictions, introduce new opportunities for someone to slip up, to make a mistake, and then for someone to discover.
That's right. And in the case of Silk Road, it wasn't even that complicated. It was just he let his email address known in a forum by mistake. It was that sort of thing. But what's interesting is that Silk Road is resilient even though Silk Road was taken down, because in a matter of days, there was another site called Silk Road 2.0 by somebody else, a copycat, sprung up. And there are other black markets like that. So I think the fact that we will have online black markets that are hidden services, that will be accepting some kind of cryptocurrency, whether it's Bitcoin or perhaps some future more anonymous type currency, that's, as you say, out of the bottle. That genie is out of the bottle, that ship has sailed.
Let's talk about the future of Bitcoin. So when we think about the virtues of the U.S. dollar right now, one is that it is very widely accepted, certainly within the United States, the only way you can pay taxes, as you said earlier on. Yet, as we transition, or, presuming we actually do transition to electronic money, right. Perhaps the gap between Bitcoin and the dollar is not quite as insurmountable as it had been before, including the kind of psychological gap, right. Towards using Bitcoin as a medium of exchange. Does that seem plausible to you? Or
I have a hard time seeing Bitcoin as a replacement for the U.S. dollar.
Partly because it can't be, because certainly it seems unlikely the U.S. government is going to accept it.
Taxes, right. But also just sort of the built-in network effects and the rest. But what I think is more interesting about the future of Bitcoin is people don't realize that Bitcoin is more than money. Currency transactions, or just exchange of value, is only one of the things that Bitcoin does. And it's sort of the most basic thing it does, and so it's the thing that's being exploited first. But Bitcoin does lots of things. So, for example, you could have a decentralized predictions market on Bitcoin. And basically, you can do this by having a transaction that is not just two parties, but it's three parties. And you could have an automated server that reports whether the price of Google went up or down. And you and I can make a transaction that this party decides who is the winner, right? So we're making bets now. It could be sports scores. It could be anything. You could have automated inheritances.
So if I'm using E-Trade, I'm always going to have to pay some kind of transaction fee for using their system.
Right.
Whereas one can imagine some kind of third-party provider operating on the Bitcoin network that either charges a much smaller fee or perhaps no fee at all.
That's absolutely right, because all they're doing is publishing data. Think about Kickstarter, right? So Kickstarter essentially is facilitating assurance contract. We all pledge little amount, and if the person who has a Kickstarter campaign meets their goal, then only then do they get the money from all the small pledges. And for that service, Kickstarter takes 5%. You can do this on Bitcoin. You can structure transactions in a way where they cannot be spent, they cannot be collected until a certain goal is met. And again, the cost there, the fee would be like under 1%. So there are lots of unexplored uses of Bitcoin still. And again, these are all decentralized. So again, think of the censorship resistance. Indiegogo is a website that's a lot like Kickstarter. It allows people to sort of kickstart different projects. And Cody Wilson, who is famous for developing 3D printed plastic handguns, started a campaign to build and design, build and put out online for free the schematics for a 3D printed handgun. And Indiegogo shut down that campaign. He was not allowed to have that fundraiser there. Okay, enter Bitcoin. You can have that kind of assurance contract that nobody can stop. There's no place you can go to put a stop to that.
There's deep skepticism among a wide swath of Americans regarding the virtues of our major financial institutions, how well they function, how well they serve their consumers, but also about their larger systemic effects. Do you believe that Bitcoin creates the possibility for new kinds of financial innovation that would allow people to operate outside of the context of the big banks?
Absolutely. I think this is something that is really, really long term. But again, within the Bitcoin protocol, there are all sorts of facilities that would allow one to have lending, that would allow one to have smart property and to have collateral.
Tell me what you mean by smart property.
So smart property is physical property that the ownership of which transfers with a Bitcoin transaction. So it could be the sort of thing where you have a car, I want to buy it from you. We make a Bitcoin transaction, and as a result of that Bitcoin transaction, it is in the ledger, that now is proof of ownership, and perhaps the key that turns on the car is tied to the private key of the person who made that transaction. So now as once I send you the money and you accept it, now the key only works for me. Only my key works for the car, I should say.
So this could also be a vehicle for fractional ownership, or yes. You know, you could have the transaction happen, you know, many more times than is practicable when you don't have that kind of a tool.
So micropayments mm-hmm. is something else that Bitcoin allows, the traditional payments networks don't allow. So if, you know, given the costs of traditional payment systems that we've discussed, having a transaction for 5 cents or even for 0.1 cents, it's impossible. Bitcoin allows for that. And using what's called micropayment channels in the Bitcoin protocol, you could have just hundreds of transactions per second. So what does this allow? Imagine walking around New York City and your phone just goes from Wi-Fi hotspot to Wi-Fi hotspot, negotiating and paying the owner of that hotspot from place to place. Today, the only way that this works is with a third party provider. You have to sign up for an account ahead of time with AT&T or T-Mobile or somebody. And if you happen to be one of their hotspots, can you use it? Well, imagine a world where all the hotspots are available to you. And you can have these little microtransactions. You don't have to pay $20 a month to one central authority, you know, every month. You can just pay fractions of a penny as you walk down the street to each hotspot. Bitcoin allows for that. The technology is there, it exists. It's a matter of implementing it. And of course, that's gonna take some doing because there are just huge network effects there.
So, I mean, you're envisioning some kind of third party that's able to operate at extremely low cost, and one could just sign up with this third party that's operating on the Bitcoin network.
There's no signing up. Mm-hmm. There's no signing up. You could just have the transactions happen. You don't have to set up an account ahead of time.
So you find the idea of Bitcoin somehow displacing the U.S. dollar very unlikely. Yeah. Yet earlier on you mentioned that, you know, of course, the U.S. dollar is not the only currency in the world, mm-hmm. nor is the euro. You have many other currencies that have had problematic histories, mm-hmm. to say the very least. When, you know, a country like Argentina mm-hmm. or, you know, in a more egregious case, a country like Zimbabwe, these mm-hmm. are places where there's very little faith in the currency right. for all kinds of reasons. Can you imagine a scenario in which Bitcoin starts to displace currencies in other parts of the world?
Sure. You see this in Argentina, where there's a very strong Bitcoin community in Argentina. A lot of folks are very interested in it. And Argentina has, 40-60% inflation. And so people are putting their money in Bitcoin. Even as risky as that might seem to you and me, they are investing into Bitcoin.
So they're actually choosing to use it as a store of value.
As a store of value.
Relative to their own currency. The Chinese government recently took action against Bitcoin. Tell us a bit about that.
I'm not sure. So it's interesting. I think that was seen as, it's funny, it's kind of like the Silk Road takedown, where once Silk Road was taken down, Bitcoin dropped in value by about 20%. And then within a matter of hours, it was back over that period. The same thing with the Chinese announcement. Bitcoin dropped in value, and now it's back up. The Chinese authorities, I think, have not done anything too differently from what the U.S. authorities have done, which is, in China, the central bank prohibited banks in the country from holding or facilitating exchanges of Bitcoin. And while the U.S. has not done anything similarly, effectively, U.S. banks don't touch Bitcoin, right? Just they're too afraid of it and the smoke signals that they've gotten from regulators, I think. And beyond that, what the Chinese government has done is required the same kind of know-your-customer type of registration, same thing we have here in the U.S. But aside from that, the Chinese government was very clear that it is still legal for Chinese people to own and use Bitcoin. So nothing much has changed there.
Well, the big killer app of Bitcoin in the Chinese context is that the Chinese government imposes capital controls that make it difficult for me to take the wealth I've accumulated in China, take it out of the country. Makes perfect sense the Chinese would want to do that because they would be very concerned about capital flight. And Bitcoin, it seems, has been used by at least some people, or certainly has been theoretically advanced as a means for people to take the wealth they've accumulated in China and spirit it away elsewhere.
I think that's right. I think it's very difficult to know exactly what's happening in China, but it seems that they've put enough of a control so they can know who's using it, but still allowing others to use it if they want to allow it, right? So you can imagine that there are still going to be folks in China at the government, a lot of folks in the government itself who want to engage in a little bit of evading capital controls.
You've suggested that, in a sense, Bitcoin is best understood as a technology akin to the World Wide Web. Mm-hmm. That's obviously a very big, ambitious claim. Tell us a bit about what you mean.
So Bitcoin is a platform for innovation, right? For all the reasons that we've been talking about, all the different things that it could be put, you know, how it can be put to use, the fact that it's decentralized. It's a platform for innovation. We don't know how somebody's going to come around and use it. If you think about the World Wide Web, when it was first invented, when Tim Berners-Lee put it out for the first time, it was a way for scientists to show documents to each other, just sort of static documents, right? It was meant to be a new way to publish journal articles, right? To be quicker, more efficient. And think about the web that we have today, where reading a static document is probably one of the few things we do. We do things like go to Facebook, which is, you know, that's a network that's user-generated, that is interactive. And Bitcoin, I think, is the same way. Bitcoin is programmable money for all the reasons that I explained. There are many parts of the protocol. There's a scripting language that is built in. We can't imagine the kinds of things that innovators are going to come up with.
There are already things that have nothing to do with the exchange of money as such. Yeah. I mean, there are things that are just, you know, kind of using it as a way to engage in all kinds of other transactions.
You have, for example, proof of existence, right? Let's say that you write a script, a Hollywood script, and you want to make sure that nobody steals it from you, or if they do, that you know you can prove that they did. Or you say you write a will, and you want to make sure you notarize that. Well, you can basically hash the text, which is a way of saying you cryptographically convert it into a series of gibberish that can only come from that text, right? So you can prove that it exists. And then you attach it to a Bitcoin transaction, which is then registered in the global blockchain at a moment in time. And so now you have a decentralized notary service that nobody can control. You can always prove that this text existed at this particular moment in time. And that can be used for any number of things. Again, you could prove I wrote this script at this time. You can prove I wrote my will and this is what it looked like at this time. Who knows what else it could be used for?
There are alternatives to Bitcoin as well, some of which have a really formidable market capitalization. Mm-hmm. Do you think of any of these as promising alternatives?
So, again, you have to remember you have centralized digital currencies, which you've had for a long time, and then you have decentralized digital currencies, Bitcoin being the first one, right? And Satoshi Nakamoto, the creator of Bitcoin, was one who solved the problem that allowed decentralized currencies to exist. Bitcoin is an open source project, and so the code base is available to anybody. All of the, if I'm not mistaken, it's all of the alternative coins, altcoins they're called, like Litecoin, Feathercoin, etc., are basically taking the Bitcoin code and improving it in some way. So they are all working off of the Bitcoin code base. I think that it's good because any advances that we make in the altcoins can be folded back into Bitcoin. But ultimately, I think Bitcoin has network effects. It's got the first mover advantage. So I think it's going to take a lot for any of these to overtake Bitcoin.
So most likely it'll be the dominant one.
I think so.
Jerry, thanks very much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.